This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's the third round of the Cup weekend, everybody. Remember when the pod was hosted by Gerald Sinstat from the team bus at 8 in the morning and the whole family would sit around the sepia-toned iPod to listen? Fast forward to 2024 and there was just enough magic, some great games and some ridiculous goals to make it all worthwhile. Arsenal-Liverpool didn't disappoint. Not being able to score becoming a recurring theme for the Gunners, who missed a lot of chances before Liverpool started to miss lots too, before eventually finding a way. Before that, Maidstone, the fairy tale of the round, beating Stevenage 69 places above them on the 4G in Kent. What a nice chap George Ellacobi appears to be. Good efforts from Blackpool, Bristol City and Bolton, who all earn replays against Premier League sides. Play them before the big boys get replays cancelled altogether. And lots of kicking the ball incredibly hard. Porro, Gibbs White, Palmer, Estupiñan and Bamford. Beyond the cup, let the bucket loads begin for Timo Werner as he joins Ange's revolution. And well done Jordan Henderson, who's completed his mission to grow the game in Saudi Arabia and now wants to come back, presumably to reinstate himself as the ally we all thought he was. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Will Unwin, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
Let's start at the Emirates then. Arsenal 0, Liverpool 2. Full Handy says, if play had continued forever, in what year would Arsenal have scored? I thought this was a brilliant game, Barry. I really enjoyed it. I mean, the sort of recurring theme that Arsenal can't score is quite funny. But neither team could really score until one of them did.
Yeah, it was a fantastic game. And Arsenal's dominance in the first half and their inability, not just to score, but their inability to score in so many different ways. It reminded me the famous scene in Pulp Fiction where Jules and Vince are in this apartment and there's a guy hiding in the bathroom. He comes out and sprays him with a hail of bullets and somehow manages to miss. And then one of them inspects the holes in the wall and says, you know, we should be dead. This is a miracle. And they go on to discuss, is it a miracle? Is it a coincidence? Is it fate? Whatever. And I suppose on any other day, we could be discussing a comfortable Arsenal win over exalted opposition at the Emirates, but we're not, and on any other day you could just put it down to one of those things, but a failure to score goals is an ongoing problem for Arsenal. They've got one sort of skanky effort against Fulham in their last three games. They've converted one of their last 61 attempts on goal, or shots on, yeah, attempts on goal. And it is clearly an issue for them. They've got 2 weeks off now. Everyone's talking about a reset and, you know, can they fix the problem with some warm weather target practice? We'll find out, I suppose. The goals will come for them again, but at the moment it's definitely an issue. But I loved this game. I really enjoyed it.
Barney Ronnie writing, this was at least a beautifully subtle and varied display of attacking impotence. Arsenal failed to score from close in, failed to score from distance, failed to score from the most imaginative angles, failed to score with headers, long shots, one-on-ones. This was an exhibition of total failing to score. In the Premier League, they've scored 37, John, compared to Spurs, who have 42, Villa and Liverpool 43, and City 45 over 19 or 20 games. Is that significant?
It appears to be significant in the sense that as a result of it, they are slipping behind their objectives. And in a game like Sunday's, where they were the better team for a significant portion of it. Listen, we've all watched a lot of darts, right, over the last couple of weeks. And there's always this thing, isn't there? You've got to put in your doubles, yeah? That's what they always say after them. Well, They're not nailing the doubles, are they, Arsenal? And that's the issue for them. And may I also share my enjoyment of this tie? To quote John Motson, a crisp, competitive cup tie. One of the good things about the FA Cup is it takes you back sometimes, doesn't it? It really throws you back into the past. And at a certain point, I felt I was about 10 years ago. watching Arsenal under Arsene Wenger, it just felt the same. Just them, their fans groaning as chance after chance misses. The post-match interview in which the manager claimed that almost his team were the moral victors. It was all there. It was good to have Arsene Wenger back as Arsenal manager. It was great fun. We've got our Arsenal back. Welcome.
Hmm. I like the idea of a game of an exhibition of 5-0-1 between Eddie Nketiah and Gabriel Jesus, and they're both on double one for 3 days at the end of it. But the interesting thing is, Will, like Liverpool sort of saw what Arsenal were doing, missing a lot of chance, and thought, we've got our way of doing that as well. It's not subtle. It's just Darwin Nunez just being around.
Yeah, well, Liverpool are desperate to avoid a replay. I think that was key. So in the first half, they thought, well, we'll just lose and then it's fine. And the second half, actually, we can win this and avoid a replay. So it's a very cunning idea. Because they were terrible in the first half, trying to pass it out the back in the most incompetent fashion and whatnot. And barely had a chance on goal apart from Trent. You can't call him Alexander-Arnold. So apologies to everyone there. And yeah, in the second half, they really picked it up. They remembered that they could attack. They were pretty good going forward. Arsenal, you know, gave them the goal in the end, but they gave them the goal because you have people like Trent who can whip a ball in, and it was very difficult to defend at that front post. Ramsdale, you know, he's not going to get it because of the positioning, and you know, the defender's unlucky that he's had to flick it in. But that's how it goes when you're just supposed to hold on, and set pieces are very important. I think, you know, is it 1 in 7 goals is a set piece in the Premier League? Well, at least it was last season. So that's what you get. Nunez is an enjoyable person to watch. You don't know what you're going to get from, you know, in good runs in behind, good bit of skill. But yeah, general chaos is what he provides. And without Salah, a bit of chaos will be quite fun for the next few weeks. You know, that was his 29th game of the season, which is quite a feat for a player. But at the same time, it was also good to see that at 0-0, Liverpool's changes were bringing on two young lads that made a difference, with Bradley and former Sudan manager Lee Clarkson coming on. And they made a difference. And with players missing, with Van Dijk missing for illness, people, AFCON and Asia Cup, that bench looked pretty weak yesterday reading it, but it shows that there is some quality there, and those players could get more of a chance in the coming weeks, which will be interesting to see for Liverpool, especially with, you know, so many competitions to play for at the moment. You know, they're back in action on Wednesday night against Fulham in the League Cup. A pretty grueling period for them, but they have the rhythm that Klopp wants, and he was talking about last week. And it was, you know, a very good victory in the end to come through the difficult phases to get a couple of goals late on to knock out a Premier League title rival is, you know, no mean feat at this stage of the season.
In the commentary, Alan Shearer kept referring to how neither team wanted a replay. And he said it about 3 or 4 times. And I began to wonder what the scenarios were going to be to avoid a replay, because Arsenal were never going to get themselves through, it became clear. So, yeah, and actually it was an own goal that started the, you know, that Liverpool's victory. It was this really strange idea. I mean, Alan Shearer, a traditionalist, you'd expect. What is it about this whole thing? Oh, the last thing you'd want is a replay. Well, and that's all to do with the fact that they don't get to go to Dubai, isn't it? That they don't get to Dubai, they don't get a round of golf. Like, maybe the first couple of days when they get to have a beer on the trip is cancelled.
I think Alan Shearer is contractually obliged to do the FA Cup replays, so he wants to also to go to Dubai, and so he's
annoyed. Exactly. Yeah,
he won't get
he's off to Bolton v Luton now.
I mean, I do wonder about replays, Baz, and somebody sent quite a good idea, which is, I mean, you know, obviously if you're a small club, you're desperate for a replay. We drew at home to Man United. I don't know, probably like 8 years ago.
It was
now.
2015,
was it?
Yes, yeah, I went to the game. It was a glorious night of football.
Yeah, the goalless draw.
It was good.
It was great. And like, we made £1 million from going to Old Trafford. Like, that is life changing, or certainly decade changing for a club like us. And Thomas Frank was saying, oh, Brentford shouldn't have to do replays. And I think Tim Stillman tweeted, you know, 5 years ago, Brentford had been like desperate for a replay, or 10 years ago, you know, away at a Premier League side. But somebody came up with this idea that if neither side wants a replay, it goes to penalties. So Arsenal Liverpool could say, We don't want a replay, either of us.
Didn't I come up with this idea on the radio yesterday, Max?
Oh, maybe that. Maybe you did. But then if one of the team wants a replay, then you have to have a replay. Is that your idea?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's a really good
that's
idea.
That's what I suggested yesterday.
Oh, thanks for calling into the show, Baz. It was kind of...
Yeah, you're welcome.
Something must have overshadowed that view you made on the radio show. And everyone's
let's not cross the streams, Will. Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to do. You know, just ask the clubs before the game or in the run-up to the game, you know, do you want a replay if it's a draw? If neither of them do, just go straight to penalties. If one of them does, then that's what you get, a replay. I think it's... I didn't hear what Thomas Frank said, but if he said Brentford shouldn't have to play replays, that seems quite an arrogant stance. Yeah,
I might have misquoted him. Yeah, I might have misquoted him. But
yeah, well, I get why he might not want one. But then teams like Brentford, you know, well, I suppose they are getting themselves into the bother... relegation bother, but you know, generally mid-table sides in the Premier League should be going all out to try and win the FA Cup if you're not in danger of relegation. And then you see some of them feeling under-strength teams, and I get that you want to give squad players a run out, but you know, I don't think Brentford have much to complain about in the way of fixture congestion. It's not as if they're, you know, battling on numerous fronts, so if they have to play a replay, tough. If you don't want a replay, win the game.
It is. Maidstone 1, Stevenage 0. Sam Corn's penalty.
Sorry, just before we move on, I presumed the main topic of conversation in the Arsenal-Liverpool chat would be the complete uselessness of a Kai Havertz, but we haven't mentioned it at all.
He's just an FA Cup traditionalist and doesn't want replays. and wants replays.
Why did they buy Kai Havertz? I mean, we'll probably get to it later, but Tottenham seems to be making the same mistake as well. Why would you buy Timo Werner? Why would you buy?
That could be good. I think that one could be good. Hasn't Kai Havertz found his feet recently? I'm sure somebody somewhere said he was starting to...
He's left them down the back of the drawer again, hasn't he? But
maybe he's found them and he's so happy to have found them. He decided to take far too many touches every time the ball came his way yesterday.
He's put them in a special place. He's just forgotten it, that's all.
Yeah. Or he's put them on the end of the wrong legs.
No, he's put the wrong ones on the end of his legs. I think not he's put them on the end of the wrong legs. That would imply that he also can connect his legs, which maybe he can. Maybe he's some kind of Playmobil Lego-type character. To Maidstone, then, the story of the round, really. They beat Stevenage 1-0, Sam Corn's penalty, just before half-time. Tom says, "Hi, Max. Quick message from a buzzing Maidstone United fan. I remember when we were relegated to the 13th tier of English football back in 1993, a level only just above park football, where Maidstone spent most of the next 10 to 15 years playing suburbs of Maidstone. And to see the team getting to the fourth round for the first time in its 127-year history is quite something. I'd love a home draw against the big Premier League team or Spurs in the next round. As you may know, Maidstone have an artificial pitch. And as I understand it, FA Cup rules allow matches to be played on artificial turf. Whose tantrum would be funnier when they realise this? Pep, Arteta, Klopp or Ten Hag? I'm going Klopp for maximum passive-aggressive value. Love the pods. Keep them coming," says Tom in Brighton. I mean, it's such a brilliant story, Barry, isn't it? And like, a Maidstone's history, as Tom has outlined there, is a really interesting one.
Yeah. Back in 92, they got turfed out of the Football League because they went bankrupt. They didn't have their own ground. They were sharing with Dartford, I think. They used to be managed by Alan Carr's dad, the famous Graham Carr. They ended up in the fourth division of the Kent Counties League. They worked their way back up slowly to the National League, and then they got relegated last season. So they're now in the National League South, which is 4, 5, 6 tier. So I guess when they got a home draw, they were like, yes. And then when they got Stevenage, it was boo. But they've won this now. And, you know, obvious due respect to Stevenage, etc. But it was a great win for them. They had to ride their luck. They have a player in Gavin Hoyt on the pitch who used to play for Trinidad and Tobago. He's once shared a pitch with Lionel Messi and famously said the only time he got near him was, this was a game in Buenos Aires, a friendly, I think he said the only time he got near him was when he stood beside him at a corner. But yeah, there's lots of good little stories there. They're a Phoenix team, basically. And we were lucky enough to have their, I think, chief executive, Bill Williams, on yesterday, who's been through it all with them. He's seen, you know, the absolute lows and this super high. And he was a really fascinating character, a great talker. I think he's 81 years old. He'd been out disco dancing half the night, but he's still good enough to come on and chat to us on the radio yesterday. I think their last big cup shock was, or success, they beat Stevenage in 2014. So that was their sixth game in this cup campaign. They played three qualifiers and then beat Chesham, Barros, Stevenage. And George Alacobi, their manager, you know, I hadn't given him a second thought in years, but he obviously wants to go to Molyneux to face his old club Wolves. Mr. Williams wants a draw against Newcastle because he's a fan. Interestingly, Maidstone actually nearly relocated. They wanted to relocate to the northeast many years ago when they were in the doldrums, but they weren't allowed to. That could be, you know, if they got Newcastle, that could conceivably have been a derby. Yeah, it's a great story and fair play to them. I really hope they get a good draw.
And, Will, I mean, it was so FA Cup third round, this game, you know, like the chances that Stevenage missed and like the last 2 minutes of injury time where literally every Mason player is just kicking it as high and as far as they possibly can.
I mean, we also need to mention the fact that for the penalty, the goal scorer did have tissue up his nose as well, which is gloriously,
yeah, absolutely, yeah, good point.
Gloriously third round FA Cup. It's what we need. I mean, obviously, this is all a bit of a con from Maidstone. Their goalkeeper played for Brazil under 20s. Right? He must be good. He would have played with some great players. They're just, you know, it's just all a front, isn't it? They're actually, they've got people that played against Messi, Brazil internationals. It's a farce. Yeah, I think actually, previously, we really enjoyed muddy pitches, and that was a great leveler. Now, actually, perfect fake pitches are the great leveler because other teams don't know how to play on them. The ball bounces a bit too high, maybe. It whizzes off them. I think when you win, 1-0 is the perfect score. Having the ball bounce off the bar, post, every sort of limb and whatnot was great. The place looked packed, looked bouncing. It was fantastic for everyone to see. And as we say, hopefully they get Wolves in the next round for George Alacobi, because he seems such a lovely man afterwards. He's, you know, you won't mess with him still. He's kept up with his fitness, it's fair to say. Obviously, it does involve Wolves having to get through a replay, so apologies to everyone at Wolves for that. But yeah, it looked like a good day out, and hopefully they'll be able to take that on the road or drag some Premier League giant back to Maidstone, because yeah, that's what this is. What the FA Cup is all about: teams avoiding replays, one, and getting, you know, the smallest team left getting through to the fourth round, which is exciting to see.
And that kind of was the magic-y bit, John, wasn't it? You had these almost. There were so many almosts, weren't there? You know, like Eastleigh getting a draw at Newport County is a great result. Chesterfield being one up at Watford. Blackpool being 2-0 up at Forest and QPR being 2-0 up on Bournemouth, but none of them could quite
see. Cambridge, Max, being ahead twice against Blackburn. Don't forget that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, as we might discuss, I was actually in Kent. I was in Gillingham and sat next to the chap from the Kent Messenger. And of course, you realise that the big Kent story was happening with Maidstone rather than Gillingham. So there was a bit of, a bit of excitement for them, but obviously thinking they've missed the story. Chesterfield, who I did a piece on for Saturday's paper. It looked like they might be the ones, didn't it, for a while. Had a chat with Robin Cowan about it, saying how close it was. And yeah, that was a shame, that, because I think Chesterfield fancied they had a chance there. You know, when you have clubs in the top two divisions, you expect them to rest, and then the lower league teams think they've got a chance, but it didn't quite come off, did it? And I think only two teams not in the draw from the Premier League, I think Burnley and Arsenal, I think that's right. Obviously, Manchester United can always come through and deliver the well, the giant killing of themselves. That's always possible. But yeah, the Cup of Dreams, as we've referred to it a couple of years ago. A Cup of Dreams. Yeah. It delivered dreams, but not quite the fairy tale.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Morgan Gibbs' white goal was brilliant. Daniel Grimshaw, a number of goalkeepers made some brilliant saves in the third round. Daniel Grimshaw made a save from Ryan Yates late on that meant Blackpool got a replay. Maybe I was the only person to realise that's where Asmir Begovic is when I saw him picking the ball out of the net for QPR. But he had quite a good game in that win for Bournemouth, didn't he? West Ham, Bristol City, that's a great result, Barry, for Bristol City to get a replay there.
Yeah, that looked like a really good game. Obviously, I only saw highlights. Weirdly, there was only one game shown live on UK TV on Sunday afternoon out of, what, nine? There was one on the button, on the red button.
Yeah, it was on the button. This must have been some sort of technological experiment. And like you, I ended up watching Boreham Wood v York City, which was good fun. But until someone pointed me to the fact that it was on iPlayer. It wasn't the best advertising, that really, was it?
Yeah, I presume there'd be an array to choose from, but there wasn't. Anyway, but West Ham Bristol City looked really, really good. Lucas Paqueta with another wonder pass to set up Jared Bowen, who... Does anyone bring a football down as well as Jared Bowen? His touch is just absolutely incredible. Yeah. So I just seem to recall him on so many occasions this season.
I'd say Berbatov. Berbatov is the king of just controlling goal kicks out of the sky with even more grace. You know, he's like an effective Havertz, Berbatov, I would say. Whereas Bowen is a bit busier about it, but I don't dismiss your point.
I mean, I remember Jared Bowen, I think I've mentioned this before, talking about working on his fitness on his dad's farm in Hereford. And I think I imagine him just having someone launch balls at him from distance in a ploughed field, and he's just bringing them down.
Someone launching a cabbage at him.
Although a cabbage, if I remember this, I remember distinctly. Do you remember someone threw a cabbage at Steve Bruce?
Yes. It came apart as it approached him. So sort of like cabbage shrapnel in the Steve Bruce mullet. Yeah.
Well, I was filming something where the piece was going to finish with someone throwing a cabbage at my head. And then it transpired that cabbages are really heavy. And so actually, if you were practicing your control with cabbages, every time you controlled it would stop dead. So I don't think it would be helpful in your footballing education.
So you need a more bouncy vegetable.
Yeah, you need a bouncier vegetable, yeah. Anyway.
A rolled up hay bale or something, yeah.
Yes.
Jared Bowen's ability to take down a football and just kill it is second to none as far as I can tell. And he scored a brilliant goal. Tommy Conway scored a good goal for Bristol City, running on to a lovely through ball from Joel Williams.
Oh, that pass was amazing.
Just incredible. Through the eye of a needle. Bristol City keeper Max O'Leary was outstanding. There were great chances for both teams, and it looked like an absolute ding-dong of a cup tie.
Mm. Also, well done to Bolton, who got a goalless draw at Luton, so they get a replay as well. And a word on the other non-league side that was still in it, Aldershot. They did get hammered by West Brom. It was nice and sunny. It featured miss of the round from Leighton Love, clean through and then kicking it almost over the stadium for West Brom. But Tommy Widrington, their manager, the Aldershot manager seemed quite happy afterwards. They scored. That was nice. Their fans celebrated and they had a really good cup run. So well done to Aldershot. Hopefully that didn't sound too patronising. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at the Stadium of Light. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. We'll be right back. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ryan says, has a team ever been as accommodating to their derby rivals as Sunderland were for Newcastle? Decorated their own stadium in black and white, opened the scoring for them, gifted them a second and a third before letting them take a nice team photo on the pitch. Very generous. To you, Barry.
Yeah, this was a very disappointing performance from Sunderland. You know, in the build-up to the game, Newcastle are obviously on this dismal run of form. They've got this draw, this horrible draw for them at the stadium, like, because I wouldn't say everyone was expecting them to win, but if they'd have lost, it would have been embarrassing for them. I think it would have ramped the pressure up on Eddie Howe. And everyone sort of fancied Sunderland to give them a good game, and that just didn't happen. Sunderland, I don't know, their young side, I don't know if they're a bit overwhelmed by the occasion, because many of them will never have played in an atmosphere like that. But they didn't really get anything resembling a foothold in the game until after they were 2-0 down. And even then, they were restricted to pot shots from distance, a couple of which could have gone in. I think Martin de Bradford got a bit lucky from a Pierre Ekwa shot that sort of, he dived and it hit his foot. You could either say it was a very lucky save or a brilliant save. And it was Ekwa, that came moments after Ekwa had gifted Newcastle their second goal. And then Dan Ballard, who had a very strange game insofar as he scored an own goal, which wasn't really his fault. There wasn't much he could do about it. He also conceded a penalty. He was very lucky not to concede a second penalty, and was also one of Sunderland's best players. So I think that tells you all you need to know about Sunderland's performance, that one of their best players scored an own goal and conceded a penalty.
It might sound ridiculous, Will, to say it felt good that Newcastle still really cared about this game. Because I guess some derbies become sort of pity derbies, you know, when there's a big gulf. And I know Sunderland aren't doing badly in the Championship, but these teams are in totally different realms now. So it did feel important to me that Newcastle gave a shit. But I guess Newcastle fans will say, well, of course we do. This game is so historical for us. We haven't played it for years. It was an absolute sellout. You could hear the Sunderland fans every time. It was like Longstaff had about five chances he kept missing, and the Sunderland fans were getting very excited about it. But I was sort of pleased to see that they still cared about it.
Well, yeah, they had to put out a strong team purely on the basis of their form recently. This is what they've got left to play for. So that played into the hands of it. But it is, you know, it's a sort of microcosm of football. It's all very close, quite tight. You know, you'll know a lot of each other, fans from each of the other clubs. And on top of that, everyone that ever sees a Newcastle player at the supermarket for 2 weeks prior to that is going to be in their ear telling them that they need to be up for it. Eddie Howe knows the importance of derbies, and that if they did lose, as Barry said, it would be a problem for him. But the whole pressure at the moment, with pretty average form at Newcastle, would have been ramped up. And you know, the weird attempts at welcoming them from Sunderland in the build up were very odd. And you know, having a bit of needle and doing the selfie afterward, the photo afterwards in front of the away fans, it's good fun. You know, when these derbies don't come around as often as you may like because the other team's in a different division, it doesn't make the rivalry any different. You know, it's not like Sunderland play in a 5,000-seater stadium just down the road. It's a massive ground. It's a massive club packed out, and silencing them is as much fun as silencing any Premier League team because you know how much they hate you. And apart from the fact that Sunderland was so meek in that first half until it got to 2-0 was, you know, probably the only negative for Newcastle, that it was a bit easier than they might want it to. They might have wanted a bit more in your face from Sunderland early on. But they did their job well. They played well. And, you know, they'll be looking at that as a springboard for what comes next after, you know, with Man City coming up. So it'll be an interesting one if they can build on it.
The build up to this game. And Barry wrote a piece for this on Football Daily about Sunderland's, you know, redecoration of their facilities. Now, I understand why they did this, because I went to Cardiff Swansea about 10 years ago, and Ellis could tell you about this, where they, you know, where they kettle fans in buses, and then when you get into the ground, they've painted it in maybe neutral colours at that time, or the colours of Swansea, to make sure that you don't rip the place down. And I pointed this out to the local reporter, who I know, and on Twitter, and I receive a deluge of people saying, but you can't do that, you know, you can't. And I did think, isn't this rivalry a bit silly? And I'm accused of not knowing anything about the Northeast, about football rivalry, or being a football fan, or anything like that. And I do think about this, that maybe because I'm moving on in years, that maybe, or maybe because of the profession that I'm in, I don't take it as seriously as some people. But when I look at that and I think, people were saying things like, well, that's what we've got stewarding for, yeah? Well, the thing is, if you're a steward and you are involved in an incident, you can still be on an assault charge. If someone gets arrested for vandalising stuff, the money, the overtime is charged by the police to the club and all this type of thing. And I think that's what they attempted to do. Now, I'm sure they went completely over the top, and it felt there was a bit of devilment, wasn't there, in paint, getting rid of Howey and cheer up Peter Reed and all that stuff. I suspect a Newcastle-based contractor was called in to do this job. But I understand why they tried to dampen this thing down. And I do think, and this is football, maybe we all need to grow up a bit. Even I've managed to grow up. You're talking to someone who still has a
tattoo of Russell Beardsmore on their bottom.
There's someone who still has a sort of almost Pavlovian reaction to someone wearing a Liverpool shirt. You're talking to someone who, in the 30s, me and my mates are in West Park, Macclesfield, and found a Liverpool shirt and we burned it. Yeah? In my 30s, it's absolutely ridiculous. I've been a football journalist for years at that point. But what I'm saying is, I get it. But come on.
Do you know what?
I can kind of see your point of view, John, in that I'm getting old and I care increasingly less about this kind of, you know, fanaticism. But my understanding is that this rebranding was done in a corporate hospitality area, which was going to be full of Newcastle fans paying £600 a head and were unlikely to, you know, turn the place into a Western saloon bar brawl. And, you know, by all means, take down some of the Sunderland branding, but you don't have to put up Newcastle branding, you know.
No, I agree with that. But, I mean, the overall point, I think, was to try and neutralise this behaviour. And the reaction, I was like, they should... It was as if no one could be trusted to do this. And it was almost as if that was expected. And I'm sorry, I've never been involved in football violence or anything like that, but sometimes you just take a step back and you think, really? Come on.
As far as I know, they certainly used to, I don't know if they still do, but Brighton, when they opened the Amex, they would light the away end in the colours of the visiting team, and in the bars would sell, so say if Newcastle were in town, which was the game I was at, my only time at the Amex, they were selling Newcastle Brown Ale. You know, they'd sell the local hooch of whatever team was visiting. I presume just as a nice gesture or whatever. I don't recall anyone ever getting particularly upset about that.
It's not quite the same, but obviously there are loads of stories about, you know, Tottenham fans who wouldn't buy a JVC telly and Arsenal fans who wouldn't drink Holston pills. But Paul Hawksby tells this story that he did a phone-in on this and an Aston Villa fan was with his family. I may have told this story before, but Aston Villa fans with his family, right? The pissing rain on the motorway late at night and their windscreen gets, you know, a bird flies into the windscreen, right? And it's smashed. And they're waiting for hours by the side of the road. And then the man comes from Auto Windscreens to fix the windscreen. He says, nope, I can't have a Birmingham sponsor fixing this windscreen. We'll wait for someone else. Blimey, that is real commitment to the cause, isn't it? Anyway, Wrexham won 1-0 at Shrewsbury. They are the league below. I mean, Shrewsbury had so many chances in this game. Like you know, this is Wrexham absolutely got away with this. I mean, Shrewsbury should have won about 100-0, Baz.
Yeah, it was remarkable how many chances they missed. And the Wrexham goal wasn't pretty, but they all count. It certainly wasn't a Bamford-style finish. We'll get to him. But I had no idea that the Shrewsbury manager is, what's his name? I've now forgotten.
Portsmouth's Matty Taylor,
yes. So yeah, another blast from the past. I like that about the third round. You get a lot of blasts from the past. Former Sunderland, inverted commas, legend and Scotland international. He scored Eastleigh's equaliser. But yeah, quite how Shrewsbury contrived to lose that game is remarkable. But, you know, hopefully Wrexham will get a big draw in the fourth round, because they have been somewhat starved of publicity and finances in recent seasons.
I think Welcome to Wrexham won an Emmy last night, I think. Well done to them.
Good day for them.
Absolutely. Or a Golden Globe or some sort of thing. You were at Gillingham for to see Sheffield United win a game, John. I'm afraid we don't really, not really a lot we need to say about it, apart from I enjoyed the Gillingham defending for one of James McAtee's goals, where they all just disappeared. It was like the Red Sea, wasn't it?
Yeah, he really enjoyed himself. Very talented player, obviously playing a few levels against players below his level, and he enjoyed it. What did he enjoy about this? Good indie pre-match thing, including our friends the Cortinas, and being quite close to hear Chris Wilder screaming at his team. I'd be very afraid if I was a Sheffield United player. And also post-match, in which he was asked, you know, will you be taking the lads away to Dubai or whatever? Nope. 2 weeks working hard on the training ground. So good luck, Sheffield United players. You're in for a treat.
Will, you were at Stoke for Stoke 2, Brighton 4, of which Pervis Estupiñan's goal was the highlight, certainly for me anyway.
Yeah, it turns out that just whacking the ball really hard from distance with a very good left foot, a cultured left foot, because all left-footed players are cultured, is a good idea. You know, the Brighton were pretty dominated possession, but were playing at about 75% of the general tempo they should be. But if you score a goal in the fifth minute of stoppage time in the first half, when from nothing, from a ball coming out to the edge of the box, because your left back is really, really good at football, and kicking the ball very, very hard, then it, you know, kick-started the momentum. They conceded a penalty to take it back to 2-2, but they were just far too much quality. The main thing I took out of it was I was very surprised to find out that former Aston Villa striker Wesley plays for Stoke.
Yes.
And that was his 19th appearance of the season, and he's yet to score. And he's yet to score because he's the most immobile forward I've seen in the professional game. He could not move. It was an issue
That's
for him.
Tremendous.
And also, Mamadi Sidibe's 16-year-old son came off the bench for Stoke, which was fantastic. Mamadi, who...
I think he's played before, I saw him early season.
It was his fourth appearance or something. His father still owns a bakery in Stoke, or the vicinity of. So it did make me feel very old.
I was going to say, does that make you feel older than Danny Cadamatri's son? Because, like, you know, as we've already established, Danny Cadamatri can only be 22 himself.
I keep thinking that's Danny Cadamatri.
Not his son. I also, on names, Watford's equaliser was set up by someone called Yasser Asprilla, and I did check. He's no relation to Tino Asprilla. Finally, for part two, Andrew says, did the absence of VAR in most of the games highlight how pernicious and unnecessary a tool it actually is? There was football, there were referees and fans, it was entertainment, and it worked. Baz?
I think so, yeah. I didn't enjoy the Newcastle or Sunderland-Newcastle game, but I think if VAR had been employed for that game, it would still be going on. Because there were some quite meaty challenges and decisions that, if VAR had got involved, it could have taken ages. There's one in particular that springs to mind. It was a penalty call.
The Ballard on Isak penalty call, that one?
Ballard on Isak, yeah. And then there was another one as well, I think a potential handball. But please excuse my bad memory, but there's so much football over such a short space of time. There was, you know, just the refs were making decisions. Some of them were a bit contentious, some of them were wrong, but, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. And if VAR had been involved, there'd still have been contentious decisions and some of them would still have been wrong. So, but look, it's here, it's not going away, so just have to enjoy the games we see where it isn't involved.
At Stoke, Lewis Dunk got done for a handball. It was a header from a couple of yards away for corner. It looked like it might have hit another part of Dunk's body before hitting his hand. His arm was outstretched, and it, you know, definitely hit his hand. Paul Tierney, who's one of the Premier League's, you know, more highly rated referees overall, gave it straight away. There was a bit of moaning, and then everyone gave up and they took the penalty. It was quite nice. Just to, you saw two replays. You know, you get a little screen in the press box. You get a couple of replays like, yeah, maybe, whatever. Looks, it's justifiable. That's fine. Take the penalty. Everyone moved on. I mean, you had 6 minutes of injury time through injuries in both halves at Stoke. So I quite enjoyed the fact that it was really quick, no messing about.
It was a handball that really made me angry. But you're right, I didn't have time to get even angrier because they didn't show me 1,000 replays of it. Anyway, that'll do for part two. We'll begin part three with Patrick Bamford. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jay says, why is Patrick Bamford not on that plane after that goal? Wayne, how good was it to see A, Patrick Bamford score a worldie after two awful years, B, for it to be against Peterborough? He said afterwards, it was a nice goal. A goal's a goal. I'd be equally happy if I scored a tap-in. But, John, that was absolutely joyous, that goal, wasn't it?
Oh, it's a beauty, yeah. It's goal of the season, surely. Hang on. Is that a better goal than Garnacho? I'm saying...
I think so.
I think it is, yeah.
I think there's less fortune involved in Bamford's. That's all skill.
The problem with Garnacho's thing is he keeps trying it and he's diluting how good that goal that goal is. Yeah. Whereas Bamford, he's not going to get the opportunities. I mean, that just the take and... It needs a 70s crowd. It needs the advert selling Rizler and, you know, Bass Bitter or whatever, and a Barry Davis commentary to make it, you know, an all-time classic. It's that sort of vintage of goal, isn't it? It's absolutely beautiful. And the hair as well is amazing.
Yeah, I think there's probably people listening who haven't seen it. So it's kind of a long diagonal to, what, 5 or 6 yards outside the penalty area from Ethan Ampadu. He takes it down at the very top of his chest and then in one move turns and spanks a volley with his left foot. Brilliant technique, straight into the back of the net. And you know it's brilliant when his own players put their hands on or his own teammates put their hands on their heads with disbelief. Opposition players put their hands on their head reacting with disbelief. And one of the Peterborough stewards actually does a fist pump.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's something about a centre-forward just chesting one out of the sky anyway, let alone then swivelling and absolutely melting this ball. And like, he doesn't have time to look at the goal. He's just, it's all sort of, it's instinct, but just pure quality. And he's got that, Bamford. Like, he's got that ability. I know there was sort of talk a few years ago of whether he would be the player you'd put on that plane if Harry Kane, you know, just in case Harry Kane got injured, because he can bring others into play. He's already had a really rough time of things. And yeah, I think everyone was utterly delighted to see that go in. Ethan Ampadu had never scored in English football before and scored two and set that one up, but no one's talking about it because he didn't do what Patrick Bamford did.
I was going to say, we taught Patrick Bamford all he knows, of course, after he,
after he came
may or may show. Not have attended our Leeds show. Mm. Unconfirmed.
Yes. Unconfirmed. And if he did go, he will have heard the story you told, John, that can never be told again.
That's true.
Another good goal was Pedro Porro's brilliant goal for Spurs against Burnley. I thought that would be the goal of the round until Bamford and a couple of others absolutely smashed that ball in. But, I mean, the more interesting stories are about Spurs are transfer-based. Edward says, are Spurs basing their management hires and player recruitment on your hot takes on the pod, Max? James, is Ange bringing in Timo Werner the most Max transfer ever? Hashtag bucket load. Sebo saying there are a few things funnier than Timo Werner scoring the buckets he was meant to for Chelsea at Spurs. I can't think of those funnier things right now, but I'm sure they exist. John, you're not... I think this is a really good purchase. You can't really buy anyone in January. He really is... He's incredibly quick. He needs a manager who loves him, and like, you know, and that's what Ange will do.
Yeah.
And I just think he'll score buckets.
Ange is a good repairer of players, isn't he? That's true.
He's like the repair shop. People, I've brought you in Timo Werner, and then Ange delicately takes a whittle to him and a lathe or whatever, and he comes back and he's fully RB Leipzig.
I've got you a V8 Ute. What can you do with it? Yeah. But I mean, he, I suppose the thing is, though, that there is a slight element that Timo is damaged goods in that he can't get into the Germany team at the moment. Now, I think we're all agreed, and you always write them off at your peril, but this is not a great Germany team. That's part of the move. He's trying to put himself in the window, so to speak, into Julian Nagelsmann's eye line by moving to the Premier League. But, and I agree with this point, actually, he has the pace, he has the positional awareness that would probably work in an Ange team. Does he have the finishing skills? Well, anyone who watched him play at Stamford Bridge over those couple of years will know that finishing is not his great, is not his strongest point, but he is a cult hero at Chelsea.
Not anymore, I imagine.
That cult may have reached its end, yes. For playing very, very well when they reached the Champions League final, won, of course, played a big part on that night. Signing a striker that's known for missing a lot, they always tend to miss a lot, don't they?
Yes, you might be right.
No, but as you say, Max, there's not a lot else out there, and Spurs do need bodies in, because it would appear Madison, his injury is quite serious, and Son isn't going to be back till, we don't know, mid-February it could be, so yeah.
It's a more sensible loan signing than Vuk Veghorst last season. So at least he looks like he might be a Premier League player and might fit into the system. So fair play to Tottenham on that they've acted swiftly and signed up.
I was hoping Big Sir Jim might get Big Valk back. You know, it could.
You do need a centre back, to be fair. So he could be put that in there. Yeah.
Well, what do you make of Eric Dier to Bayern Munich? That sort of made my eyebrows slightly when I heard it.
Do you think Harry Kane's hotel room will have an adjoining door to Eric Dier's?
Harry's moved, unfortunately.
I don't think Bayern will put Eric Dier in the same quality hotel room.
Harry Kane's rented one of the houses of someone out on loan, or someone Bayern have sold. So maybe the pool house will be for Eric, and it'll sort of be like Curb Your Enthusiasm. Eric's out there, pops in every day. You know, it's just nice to have friends there, isn't it? You know, Dyer's a perfectly competent centre-back, maybe not a top six level at this stage of his career. But, you know, you don't have to be for most of the league games for Bayern. You can have quite a relaxed time. He seems like a relatively decent bloke. Speaks a couple of languages, yeah. You know, if you're not going to use him at Spurs, you might as well have a change of scenery in Munich, probably play about half the league games and get a winner's medal at the end of the season.
I think it's a brilliant move for him. And I think he's kind of loved by Tottenham fans, because, like you say, he's a good guy. He's been a great servant. He's clearly not an Ange's pans. But, you know, it would be so wonderful for him and his career to go somewhere. And he could come away with a league title and a Champions League winner's medal. It's not inconceivable if you go to Bayern Munich.
And he is quite, as Will said, that's a good point. He's quite a cultured lad. Do you think he's going to take, you know, him and Harry will do a few galleries, or, you know,
just hang out in the Tiergarten? I mean, it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful parks in the world, I'd say.
They could go down the U-Bahn and look at my blue plaque.
My good. Simon says, judging by how quickly Jordan Henderson's completed his mission to grow the game successfully in Saudi Arabia, how quickly would he get the economy growing again if we made him Chancellor of the Exchequer? Yeah, this is the news, Barry, that Jordan Henderson turns out isn't that excited playing in front of sparse crowds in a poorly managed Al-Ettifaq.
Yeah, it seems to be a genuine story. It's been sort of fed to lots of the Liverpool correspondents. I think Matt Hughes broke it in the Daily Mail. He's generally on the ball. And it just seems like poor old Jordan really didn't do his due diligence before going to Saudi Arabia. He seems surprised that it's quite hot and muggy out there, that Al-Ettifaq aren't drawing big crowds. I think their average crowd is 7,000. Often they play in front of quite a smaller number than that. The team isn't performing well. Steven Gerrard's job is under threat. Steven Gerrard's assistant has just left to go and manage Plymouth. And so it's all going wrong for Jordan. And I think, you know, people make bad decisions and they're entitled to change their minds. But if he does come back, he will, of course, be pilloried because of the whole LGBTQ plus business where he's the hypocrisy he's shown, and members of that community have accused him of betrayal, and I think they're perfectly entitled to. And so if he does come back, where does he go? I think there has been talk linking him with a move to Newcastle, which would be interesting considering he's a Sunderland lad, born and bred. And that would be another misstep, which would make him even more unpopular. I presume he also still fancies his chance of getting in the England squad for the Euros. And I would imagine that is unlikely to happen unless he comes back to the Premier League.
Hmm. I mean, I guess the point is, John, he was playing quite regularly in the Premier League not that long ago. And in pure footballing terms, you know, he's super experienced. He is a good person in the dressing room. And all those things would help quite a lot of Premier League sides, you'd imagine.
Yeah, I suppose if you're a struggling team, you want to maybe add a player of experience. I suppose that there's this question of how much is left in Jordan Henderson's legs. It's clear that Liverpool didn't feel there was. Jürgen Klopp and Henderson had a chat, which was essentially, listen, you're not going to be the first choice next season. That sped the decision up. But in the Premier League, you need legs, don't you? And is he going to be one of these players that when they get a bit old, they just do a lot of pointing rather than actual running? I suppose one thing is, actually, it could be a boost to the economy if he comes back, because they'll be faced with a fairly enormous tax bill. So this could be the lift that Rishi needs, the return of Jordan Henderson with his wages. Actually, I'm struggling to think of a club who would, you know, maybe a Forest or someone like that, where he'd fit in, but it's going to be difficult. Also, his wages are not going to be high, are they? Does he need the money, I suppose? And as Barry said, the hypocrisy that he was accused of, that interview with Adam Kraft and David Ornstein, which didn't really further his cause particularly much, it backfired a bit.
I would say it made it worse.
Yes, absolutely. he's got a lot of rowing back to do. Good luck to him, because, listen, I don't think Jordan Henderson is a bad person in any sense, but I think a misfire, a misadventure, and it could be a useful player for somebody, but it's an embarrassment, really, for him to have to come back after so little time, really.
And, of course, there's every chance that Etifak won't let him come back, because it would be an embarrassment for them and the Saudi League if he left this quickly.
Yeah, in which case, best of luck.
I think you're probably right. Can I point you in the direction of the Guardian Women's Football Weekly? News of another ACL. Sam Kerr, obviously one of the best players in the league and the world, did her ACL out at a sort of summer training camp, with Chelsea, which is devastating news for her. It's not her first ACL, I don't think. And they were discussing that amongst all the other things going on in the women's game. Finally, some Pascal Chimbonda news, Will. Obviously, you've been following Skelmersdale United. He is their manager. And here is a statement regarding his 5-match stadium ban. Following today's personal hearing, the FA Appeal Board agreed by majority that the 5-match stadium ban originally imposed on Pascal Chimbonda to be excessive. In order to give effect to this decision, the Appeal Board have now issued Pascal with a 3-match touchline ban and have issued him with a £50 fine. Although we believe the punishment is still excessive, we're much happier with the outcome. This will allow Pascal to continue working, whereas the original ban, had it been upheld, would have prevented him from doing so. Providing there aren't any postponements over the next few games, Pascal will be able to return to the dugouts in time for our away game at Gig Lane, Bury. In other news, Pascal is now registered as a player, and we could indeed see him play against Bury on Saturday the 27th of January. So does that mean he can't... Does the ban still last for 3 games? Or can he register as a player and therefore...
Put himself on the bench...
Yeah.
But can't sit on the bench, but maybe if he wants to come, he can just run straight from the changing rooms out onto the pitch.
It's not as good as I originally thought. I thought they were, I think this is the same ban. It's the same length of ban. It'd be much more fun if, in that other news, he could come on and just play the next
game. I hope he's coughed up the 50 quid.
Yeah, I'm sure he will have done. You've chatted to Pascal. Yeah. He's a man of honour.
Well, he's not. Well, I've got an exclusive of whether he is or not.
Okay.
So when I went to the game against Kendall Town, I was in earshot of Pascal and the Kendall Town chairman. And they had a bit of back and forth. This would make it into my piece. And the Kendall Town chairman said, well, you know, it's your first game, you know, but we're playing you in December. If you beat us, I'll buy you dinner. And if we beat you, you buy me dinner. And that game obviously took place in December. Kendall Town won. And the Kendall Town chairman is yet to hear from Pascal about the dinner.
Wow.
Not even got a mint cake out of it, yeah.
So he wants a steak dinner at Miller and Carter. I can tell you that exclusively.
What's Miller and Carter? I think it's not like Frankie and Benny's.
It's a sort of steakhouse chain of, I would describe as mid-range.
A mid-range steakhouse chain, that's exactly.
Is it better or worse than Angus?
I'd say better.
Better than the Aberdeen Angus red signage. Okay, that's good.
That you've never seen anyone go in or come out of. Yeah.
No, I don't know anyone who's ever eaten in one of them, but they always appear to be full.
Yeah, but you've never seen anyone come out of there, have you?
Are you saying they're all actors? Is this a conspiracy? Oh no!
You've never seen anyone come out, but it's full. Have they been in there forever? Like, do they need rescuing? They need a negotiator standing outside all the Aberdeen and Angus steakhouses going, we'll get you out of here. Anyway, that'll do for today, I imagine. Thank you so much, Will.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll do a Europod tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.